Welcome to the Global Tech Leaders Podcast, where we help business leaders and individual contributors with actionable insights to hit their number and figure out the nuances of truly operating a business globally today, squeezing the essence of the lessons learned from the planet's top tech leaders. This is your guide to joining the fast track to global market scaling.
Welcome, I'm Ross Lauder, your host from Single Focus Talent, and I'm joined by our non-exec director, John Quigley, today.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Welcome to this week's show. I was excited to have Kevin Parker of HireVue on today's show. HireVue works at more than 600 organizations across the world, including 30% of the Fortune's most admired, including clients like American Express, GE, Nike, Chipotle, Nordstrom, Red Bull, Under Armour, the list goes on. He is experiencing tremendous growth in this particular organization, but has a vast level of experience across the board, literally speaking, as a senior tech executive. He comes to us today from Salt Lake City. Welcome to today's show, Kevin.
Thanks, Ross. I'm delighted to be here with you guys.
It's our pleasure to host you. I suppose let's kick it off from your own perspective. If you could just share with us where your career has taken you thus far, some of the inflection points, some of the decisions that you took to bring you to where you are today, if you could share that with our audience.
Sure. I've been in the tech industry for a long, long time at this point. My first tech job was actually in the 1980s, which sort of dates me, but been involved in the enterprise software space for almost 20 years now at this point. My background is actually an accountancy. I'm a chartered accountant by training and decided after university that I really didn't like accounting very much, but I liked being in business. So I transitioned to the operational side of the business and grew up as a CFO for many years and then became a CEO for the first time about 20 years ago. Actually more than 25 years ago, I guess, at this point. But what's united all of that is helping companies grow, helping them stabilize their businesses in unique ways, helping them define their opportunities, and trying to figure out what the right path forward is for them, both from an organic growth and from an M&A perspective.
Okay, so just to kind of clarify for our audience, Kevin, I mean, we don't want to sell you short here, and I'm not sure your levels of humility will allow you to kind of tell the great things that you've done. But at one stage, you were the interim chief executive and chairman of Polycon. You were the kind of CFO and president of PeopleSoft, which is Oracle organization. And these are all high level organizations. I mean, knowing Polycon, I think they're probably at about 3,500 or 4,000 employees right now. What was that like, your time at Polycon?
Polycon was terrific. And maybe going back to PeopleSoft is about 15,000 people too. So grew up in large organizations. Polycon was a bit of an emergency. The CEO, I was chairman of the board, the CEO left and somebody had to step in while we were looking for a new CEO. So it was helping stabilize a company that was in a little bit of a crisis, and then helping the search for a new CEO and recognizing that it was all temporary, but trying to provide some leadership to a great team and a great group of folks in a particularly trying time. PeopleSoft was a terrific experience as well. Maybe to pick up on that thread, I was the co-president and CFO through the hostile takeover with Oracle. So that was 18 months of crisis, almost on a day-by-day basis. So a lot of leadership lessons, a lot of really good experiences in trying to help teams adapt to changing circumstances, and some great mentors as well. I had the good fortune to work for Dave Duffield for a long time. Dave was the founder of PeopleSoft and now the founder of Workday, along with Anil Bushtree. So some great mentors and some great experience, and helping companies through some trying times as well. So both were really good experiences that set the stage for me to go to be a CEO all on my own.
Yeah, that's that really puts into context the current situation. It must be a piece of cake to you in comparison to that, is it?
I have said, look, if this is the worst we face, we're going to do okay. you know, HireVue ORM today, we made the transition to being virtual pretty seamlessly. But what some of those experiences, both at Polycom and at PeopleSoft, taught me is the importance of communication to a team, the importance of telling them everything that you know and telling them what you don't know and when you will know it. So sort of being a trusted advisor and guide to the company as we work through some of these challenges has really helped me. And I've drawn a lot on my experience at PeopleSoft and at Polycom in helping HireVue through these challenging times.
It's pretty good. So you're with HireVue now, very exciting organization, and congratulations on your 15 millionth video-based interview, I believe. That's quite a substantial number. Tell me a little bit about the difference in the workplace that you've noticed from, you know, back in your PeopleSoft / Oracle days or Polycom days to the kind of profile and structure of organizations these days. You know, is it hugely different, or kind of how would you describe it?
I think it is significantly different, recognizing, you know, PeopleSoft was 15,000 people, Polycom was 3,500 more or less, HireVue's 325. So it's very different experience just in terms of helping and guiding an organization and leading an organization in that context. You know, you've got to adjust your style pretty significantly. And as I often say, you know, in an organization of 300 people or 325 people, you can think up new ideas faster than the organization can accommodate them. So you really have to do a lot of prioritizing and helping people pick the top two or three things that we're working on, not the top 20 or 30, because they'll never get done. And I think technology has helped us work virtually in ways that we couldn't before. So it's very different from that perspective. We're much more adept at working from home. The majority of Polycom and PeopleSoft employees were all in a centralized office. HireVue was pretty decentralized to begin with, so we've adapted pretty quickly. But I'd say that the major thing that I've learned over time is the difference between working in a company with 15,000 people or 300 people is really trying to prioritize and pick your battles and make sure you're working on the most important things, because it's a relatively small team.
In terms of those priorities, and I'm always curious, and I ask this of people that sit in the big seat, what tools do you use, or kind of what frameworks do you use to ensure that, you know, those priorities are well understood and communicated across the organization? And I'll give you an example. So, for example, some folks use OKRs, objectives and key results. So some people use different frameworks or tools to number one, be able to define simplistically what the big rocks are, what the big goals or objectives are, and then for that to kind of, you know, permeate or percolate around the organization, and for every functional area to know that they should be collaboratively aligned to all of those corporate goals. What personally do you find useful? Do you use any tools, or is any tips there for, you know, any new CEOs stepping into the big seat? Kind of how do you simplify that whole process, or what tools or frameworks do you use?
We use OKRs pretty extensively in the organization, but I'd go back to something somebody taught me many years ago, and the system doesn't necessarily matter. As a boss of mine told me one time, unless your team can do a reasonably good impersonation of you talking about the top priorities, you haven't talked about it enough. So what happens to many companies and leaders is they say it once and they think everybody understood it. And unless you've said it 20 times, 30 times, you know, in some cases, maybe 100 times, it really doesn't permeate through the organization. So you have to really emphasize the communication. The other thing that we do at HireVue, and I've done at several companies now, is we agree on what the top four or five priorities are at the beginning of the year, and we report on those every single quarter. We emphasize that. We look at the world through those priorities every time. And so that is really helpful. A lot of times you can get hung up on is it an OKR or SMART goals or MBOs? And I think those are important, but what's really more important is just constant communication and repetition about what the priorities are.
I like that. Yeah, nearly over communicating to ensure that you leave no stone unturned in terms of people being exposed to that message. So HireVue are all about democratizing the interviewing process. Can you tell me a little bit about what that means?
And I'd delighted to. You know, we got our start almost 15 years ago now by a college student here in Salt Lake City, Utah, who couldn't get a job because he couldn't get an interview because no one came to Salt Lake City to interview college students or university graduates. And so he decided that the reason that people wouldn't come is because travel was too hard or they didn't go to a small school. And so the solution for that was video, and in particular, on-demand video, meaning you can take an interview any hour of the day, any day of the week. And that was really the foundation or the founding ethos of HireVue. It's like, we're going to help people get jobs. And we're going to take away the excuses that organizations have of it's too far or it's too, you know, it's the school's too small or, you know, you live in the wrong place kind of thing, and use video to do that. You mentioned we just completed our 15 millionth interview. Today, we interview about 1 million people every 90 days around the world. We do that in 37 languages. We've done interviews in over 180 countries around the world for customers. And we have a number of companies that, you know, will interview 1,000 people a day using our solutions. And it really helps them hire great talent and think about hiring talent in very different ways.
Kevin, I'm keen to drill into a point you kind of brought up earlier around transparency. I've worked in many organizations from a kind of hardware through to software where there have been varying levels of transparency across the organization. And I almost feel like having worked in orgs like HubSpot, et cetera, that it's a prerequisite for hiring today and kind of that millennial expectation of like complete and utter like kind of window into the org. Can you maybe tell me why HireVue is, you know, kind of poised to grab this kind of millennial culture and how you feel management has changed over the course of your career and what the expectations of today's candidates and employers is looking like out in the marketplace?
Great question. You know, I think first and foremost, particularly for sort of people entering the workforce today or younger generations, they expect you to go to them. You know, think about every interaction you have in your life, whether it's, you know, ordering a takeout meal or, you know, ordering a package from Amazon. You know, you get alerts every step of the process. Hey, my pizza's in the oven. It's been put in the car. The driver's heading down the street. You wind up with a constant stream of information in almost every interaction you have with corporate enterprises on a day-to-day basis as a consumer. Yet when you turn to the hiring process, it all falls apart. You know, you put your application in, you submit your CV, and you never hear anything. In fact, the most common complaint that applicants have is I applied and I never heard back, ever. And so there's an enormous inconsistency between the way we treat individuals as consumers and the way we treat individuals as potential employees or people that might join my team. I think that's a fundamental issue that many companies are grappling with. They also want to make sure that their employment brand is consistent with their consumer brand. You know, we work with many large organizations and they've recognized that having a bad employment experience impacts your consumer experience. You know, I'll never shop at XYZ shop again because they were disrespectful to me as a candidate. So I think that's a fundamental shift that many companies have not kept up with is the consumerization of almost every experience you have in the world today. The second thing I think is that people expect a certain amount of fairness and transparency, particularly from a diversity and inclusion perspective. And one of the things that I think that our companies really take advantage of is recognizing that by doing an on-demand interview, every candidate has exactly the same experience. Every candidate gets exactly the same questions. Every candidate gets exactly the same opportunity to talk about themselves and explain why they're a good candidate or what their teamworking skills are and a variety of things like that. That promotes fairness in a way that perhaps in-person interviews don't, recognizing there's a lot of conscious and unconscious bias in the interviewing process. You know, I walk into an organization, I have an interview, I don't know what my experience is like compared to anybody else. And if I'm a person of color, if I'm a minority, if I'm a woman, a man, you know, older, younger, I want to know and have confidence that there's a fair process here and I'm getting my fair chance.
Okay, no, that's very, very fair point. And I suppose, how does that new kind of wave of expectation, I mean, how do you demonstrate leadership today, and how would you define how culture has changed in an organization? I'm really keen to know, because you've been a part of huge organizations that have many, many multiples of thousands, but then you're in a smaller organization now. Like, how does culture shift across that, and how is that kind of millennial kind of ethos, if you will, help shape that? Like, what does culture look like for you in that sense, as it were?
One of the things that I think is important, and has always been important, but particularly with the workforce today, is I think people want to know their work has meaning, that they're advancing, society, a cause, individual access, or whatever it happens to be. I think people want a different sense of meaning in their life than just the pure economics of it. And we work very hard at HireVue to make sure that we can connect our work to the idea that people are getting jobs, that we're helping people move through and advance up an economic ladder, get access to jobs they wouldn't have had, and changing the process. You know, as I tell customers often, I've seen people do terrific job interviews sitting in the front seat of their car in the car park, because that's when they had the time. That's when they had the opportunity to answer some questions or talk about themselves and get access to jobs in ways that perhaps they were limited to because they either didn't have the time off or they had childcare responsibilities and things like that. So I think back to the original question, I think the focus on meaning, that our work has meaning, that we are adding value in some unique way, is very important to the workforce today.
Yeah, I think that given that level of autonomy to people and, responsibility number one, they know that their contribution is meaningful in the grand process, but they have the curiosity to want to understand what the grand process is as well, is hugely important. And I do like your analogy there of the guy in the car, because Ross is currently sitting in his car doing this interview as we speak in a car park. So all of that is good.
True.
So Kevin, CEOs have various indicators that they look at to gauge, their company's effectiveness, at acquiring and retaining customers. So I'm curious for our listeners, because, a lot of C-levels and CEOs in particular kind of pick different indicators as a sign of their business health. What do you look at particularly? So for example, is it month-on-month growth? Is it top line? Or what are the key things that you look at every day in your organization currently to give you some kind of gauge around the health of your business?
Well, we're a SaaS business, so retention is at the heart and soul of how we think about the business. We want to win new customers. But given the opportunity to renew a subscription, does a customer do that? And it's easy to, sometimes it's easier to get your foot in the door to start something new than to get it renewed. And when they renew, do they expand it too? Are they looking for new ways to use your solution? So we focus on a key metric that a lot of companies look at retention, both gross and net. We have a statistic we refer to which is called at-bat retention, meaning when the customer had the opportunity to sign the contract again or expand it, did they? And that's the most important indicator of our success with customers. And so we have a laser focus on that. We have going back to the four goals we described at the beginning of the year, we have a very specific numeric goal that we're trying to hit for at-bat retention every single quarter. And we watch it rigorously. We work with individual customers. We understand the challenges that they may have or the success that they may have, but that's the metric that we live by.
It sounds like customer success would be a hugely important component in number one, giving you visibility around that piece, but also to as an early kind of warning that you might have some folks as a flight risk as well in your process.
Absolutely. We have a terrific customer success organization. And our vocabulary is pretty important too, because as we think about customers, we've divorced usage, meaning our companies doing interviews on the platform with value, and meaning are they getting value from it? And those are two very different ideas. We have a number of customers historically that were using it very extensively, but they just added it to an existing process. So they didn't take advantage of it in unique ways by eliminating phone screens or by condensing the process in a very different way. And so they used the technology, but didn't get much value out of it. And so we've really been focused on making sure customers have almost a measurable return on investment in terms of dollar savings that we can generate with our platform.
I love that. I'm a huge fan of it. I kind of wrap it up as impact. Mm-hmm. So I kind of say, well, what was the impact of what we said would happen in the sales process and what is actually happening right now as the customer utilizes the solution or the software? What is the actual impact? And, I think it's fair. The onus is on, your organization or any software organization that supplies software to rigorously pursue any gaps that might be there with respect to what you told them they were going to get and then what they're actually getting.
Mm-hmm. And I think you've got to have almost a hard dollar version of that. It can't be enough to just say, well, we're getting better people. Well, what's the impact of better people? Is customer satisfaction improving? Do sales go up? You just can't have a sort of an anecdotal way of describing it. And as we work with customers, we focus on process improvement and outcome improvement, meaning am I making the process better or less expensive? And what's the impact of hiring better people? And we've developed a pretty specific vocabulary around that to describe that for customers.
Love it. I always ask CEOs this question because actually I have a quick question for you. Agree or disagree? The market intelligence strategy. The CEO should own the market intelligence strategy.
I believe that's true.
Okay. So based on that, how do you decide what markets you should go after? So there's only a couple of ways that you can really grow your market share. And again, market share would be one of them. Are you going to claim, a share in an existing market? Are you going to expand into other markets? And in terms of those strategies and in terms of deciding what markets you go after, how do you do that? What's the best way to do that?
We're very much focused on what we would refer to as enterprise class customers, meaning they've got more than 5,000 employees. And at that point, the hiring challenges are pretty unique. They've got thousands of applicants and they're hiring thousands, hundreds, if not thousands of people every year. So that's sort of a defining characteristic for us. We also look at the individual geographic or country markets to see what the characteristics of that are. Is it a market that has certain labor characteristics? Meaning, are there lots of applicants? Is there a lot of hiring going on? Are there use cases? And we very much focus on what we refer to in our vernacular as use cases. Is it graduate hiring? Is it call center hiring? Is it technology hiring? Because each of those is a different solution, and so we tend to look at the world from that perspective. And make sure that we have a meaningful problem we can solve for folks. And that drives a lot of the way we think about the world. That's moved us. We started out, obviously, as a U.S.-based company. We've got a very large presence in the U.K. today and expanding into Europe. We've got a large presence in Australia and in Asia as well. But we tend to follow customers and where their hiring challenges are.
I'm curious on a point you raised a little earlier, Kevin, in relation to why the company was founded around nobody coming to Salt Lake City to do an interview. And I suppose as we work in this post-COVID era, what is it you look for? I mean, you've obviously worked throughout the US and you've been involved in multiple organizations in different parts of the country and internationally. And I'm curious, having been a CEO, what are the criteria in terms of a business-friendly environment you look for that help you decide where is a good place to establish roots to grow employees, albeit remote in some cases?
Mostly it's really focusing on is the team available? Do we have experienced people? Are there infrastructure in place to support the organization? You know, up until recently, we did a fair amount of traveling too. So we've looked for people that have ready access to transportation and to go see customers. A lot of what we do up until February or March of this year was in person. So we're rethinking a lot of that. You know, it depends on the role. For customer success organizations, we tend to focus on people that have had similar experience. We have a professional services team, so they have to be fairly technology savvy. We are also have a large development organization, primarily in Salt Lake, but we're making that more and more remote. So it's really just an experience pool. And if I understand the question in terms of where we think about people geographically, we want them to be closer to customers than not too. So the reality is the majority of our customers are not in Salt Lake. They're in, you know, large urban areas around the world. So that's where our employees are.
Do you think as you change, you mentioned there about hiring or your focus being on enterprises, 5,000 persons plus, do you feel that the model will be less touch, more self-serve as you grow into the SMB, or will your focus remain in the enterprise?
I think it is. It will grow into the SMB space. What the opportunity with enterprise is interesting because, you know, if you're an organization with, you know, 50, 60,000 employees, you get tens of thousands of job applicants every year, good years or bad years, and so their level of pain is almost constant in that sense. Smaller enterprises sort of go up and down based on economic environment, and the retention and the renewals are not as good. And so we really focus on the enterprise because the hiring challenges are more difficult there. They have a better sense of what they're trying to do from a talent development perspective. We also see a new class of HR leaders in those markets that are more willing to accept technology and move away from the traditional "I know it when I see it" interviewing to do something more structured.
Cool. In your previous life and roles, Kevin, have you ever developed expansion strategies into Europe? And if so, have any lessons learned there that you can bring into your current expansion?
Quite a few times, actually. And I think very early in my career, one of my first forays into technology was as a controller or accountant for a company that was setting up operations in the Netherlands. And found it a fascinating experience, and it influenced my career since then. Probably the most common mistake that American companies make is hiring, particularly in the non-English speaking world, they tend to hire the person that speaks the best English. And that is not an indicator of whether they're particularly good in that market, but it's sort of an unconscious bias we all fall into. And that's happened to me many times during my career, whether it was in Europe or in Asia. And so that's a very, very common mistake. The second thing I think many American companies don't do is look at the world from that perspective, recognizing the customers are different, their expectations are different. In our particular world, the job candidates are different and have a very different expectation as well. So it's really helpful to get out from behind the desk at headquarters in the U.S. and go spend some time in the market talking to customers, understanding their issues, their decision-making processes. I think you're always better for it. But unfortunately, not everybody does it.
That's super advice and certainly something that resonates and that we've heard a few times at this stage on previous episodes. What advice would you have for recent or new CEOs in high growth tech companies? What should they focus on?
You know, it goes back a little bit to what we said at the beginning is pick your priorities. You know, I wake up every morning thinking, let's get started on this new idea today. And starting something new always means giving up on something you're already working on. You know, we have an expression at HireVue that we call STP. It's the same 20 people on every issue, right? So you're the hours in the day or your ability to do something new is often limited by, not by budget, by the ability of a very small group of people and the number of hours in their day. So picking your priorities, picking your battles is really, really important. Two, transparency and communication, particularly in today's environment. People want to know that where they stand, what's going on with the company, and having a very open and honest dialogue with regard to that, both for good and bad, is really, really important to maintain that success. Those are two things that that I would think of. And also thinking for the long term. You know, it's very easy to think about, you know, what today means, particularly in a quarterly run business or a monthly reporting environment, but making sure you're thinking for the long term and thinking far enough ahead about the challenges you're going to face.
And how do you align the VC's expectations in a funded company, you know, where you're at a series A, B, C, D, et cetera, and you obviously have an IPO around the corner, et cetera. Like, how do you balance off their objectives with what you know to be true and your shared experience, et cetera? How does that kind of dynamic play out?
Boy, that's a great question, and I wish I had some magic answer to all of that. You know, as someone once described it to me, as like trying to keep the puppies in the box at any point in time. You know, you're working, you think you're working together, and you know they aren't aligned often about what their expectations are, particularly if some have been in the organization as a VC longer than others. They have very different expectations and very different goals. And as a CEO in particular, a lot of time and effort can be spent to keeping that group of people aligned. But I wish I had some magic advice for that, but it's obviously very important and a never-ending exercise in some cases.
What makes a good board, do you think, Kevin? What would be what would be your view in terms of what makes a good board?
Well, I think in the VC environment, you often don't have a choice. They're going to pick who is on your board. But everywhere I've gone, I've always tried to get in independent directors that are not tied to a particular fund, but have a degree of expertise about something, some challenge you're facing, whether it's technology, market, customer. And so having that additional voice in the room or a voice in the chorus, as it were, is always very, very helpful. Often I find, you know, I've found over time that the VCs won't necessarily listen to me sometimes, but if I have a trusted advisor who's on the board who represents an independent point of view, that's helpful to the dialogue.
How does internationalization play into that kind of, like, so does the board say we need to go international because now is the right time, or is it at a particular funding level, or is business intelligence playing into that? Like, how do those kind of trifecta points play into that decision to go, yeah, you know what, we need to jump into Europe now or an APAC, etc., makes sense? Like, when do those conversations start?
They've, at least in my experience, they've generally started with the company rather than the board. And I think that's the in many ways the CEO's responsibility to look at those things as well. What I think often gets missed is the incremental costs of having a presence in, you know, the UK, in Europe, or in Asia. It isn't simply about hiring a salesperson, but all the drag along costs that go along with that, whether that's translation, localization, local support, local customer success, professional services. You know, there's almost a step function change. So you have to be ready to do that. And I think most people just sort of think, well, I've translated the product into, you know, X language, that's enough, I'll just start selling, and not recognize that it's a lot more complicated than that. And so as leaders inside the organization, it's our responsibility to bring forward those growth opportunities, but also make sure that we've got the right level of funding to be successful. And it's almost a step function when you move into a new market because of all the drag along costs that you need to be successful.
Sure. I've come across this so many times in my own career where I've internationalized for organizations, and I've had conversations with the HQ in the US where it's like, okay, currencies are different in different countries. We've got languages to compete with. We've got different tax to compete with as well. And it just costs that little bit more to do business here, but it's worth it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Maybe could you tell me a bit about you know, some of those conversations you've had, and maybe some faux pas, if you would, don't mention names, please, but you know, some of the kind of things where you go, whoa, we should have seen that coming, or how do we get that wrong? Or what did you learn from that experience, as it were, quirkiness wise?
I would say probably the most important thing is underinvesting and recognizing that it may not be successful in the first 90 days or 180 days or even the first year. But if in many cases, it can take a little bit longer than that. But if you underinvest, it actually prolongs the time to become successful. You know, and And as you think about what we do and working with large multinational organizations, that's the first thing they look at. You know, how many people do you have on the ground here? Where am I going to go for support? You know, when I need to call somebody, who's going to be there? And so it isn't enough, just to, as I said earlier, to have the product. But that's probably the lesson I learned over time. And that, and, you know, as I said earlier, not just hiring the person that speaks the best English.
So in terms of the cross-functional piece, because as the company expands, you get functional leaders, you know, you get some maybe directors, some VPs of the various functions from sales and marketing to support across the international business. How do you ensure that you get that kind of really all-important cross-functional interlock? And who's typically involved in those interlocks in your business?
We have an executive staff that's part of how we lead the organization, and just out of force of habit to try and make sure there's no daylight between any of us about what we're doing. When we make a major decision like that, we'll sit down and I'll go around the room and look everybody in the eye, either on video or in person, and make sure we're all in. You know, there's no, once we get to that point, there's no turning back. I don't want anyone to say, well, you know, I didn't know about that, and you know, I was concerned about this at the time. It's like either you're all in or you're all out, and otherwise we're not going forward. And that's been very helpful to make sure that there's no just, you know, after the fact dissent about, well, I didn't know we were going to open up in China, or you know, I didn't know all these risks. It's a team decision, and you know, we don't literally sign a piece of paper together, but it's almost to that point.
Do you guys do QBRs, quarterly business reviews?
We do not. You know, what I found over time, particularly for a small company, is it's almost a tax on the organization preparing for it. That, you know, we review a lot of stuff together on an ongoing basis. We have bi-weekly senior leadership team meetings that are an hour and a half or 2 hours long where we review the status of the business. But I found over time, particularly for a small enterprise, is that so much effort goes in sometimes to preparing for the QBRs that it actually takes away from other things that we're trying to accomplish.
I want to work for you. I love this. I know, genuinely, I love that approach, because, you know, even, you know, quarterly business reviews, essentially, I think they're archaic. I think that they should be really focused on quarterly, they should be called quarterly interlock reviews, or at least mm-hmm. They should be just checkpoints for are we aligned, as opposed to this kind of, and in some cases they're used as witch hunts, you know, to kind of sift people out in organizations and whatnot, in my experience. And I couldn't agree with you more. I've been involved in situations as a C-level leader for international organizations where it would take close to a week to prepare for a QBR. And again, what happens then is there's no standardization of that process. So you have, you know, 10 different business units and 10 different entities presenting different slideware and different formats. And, you know, and it's just a complete and utter waste of time. It's not agile enough in my view anyway. That's how I feel. So, wow. I mean, the music to my ears, Kevin, well done with that one. I think you're on to something there. So as we round the corner here, I just want to kind of get back to you as an individual, and, you know, we can go a little bit lighthearted here and just to understand you a little bit more. What recent purchase have you made, up to about 100 books, that has improved your life?
Oh boy, that's an interesting question. I'll have to think about that for a minute. You know, I actually bought a new pair of trainers to wear, sitting here at the desk day after day. And you know, as I told somebody, you know, I'm dressed in a business attire from the waist up and shorts from the waist down, but I need to find a really comfortable pair of shoes to wear at the home office all day. So that's probably something that I've gotten a lot of satisfaction out of. I finally found a pair of shoes to accommodate my work at home environment.
Fantastic. What is some of the best advice you ever received?
You know, I don't know if this is the kind of advice, but one of the formative points in my life, I remember being a teenager talking to my father, And you know, he said to, he said, Kevin, you know what, you're a Parker through and through. And I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and grew up in New York. And my father said to me, you're never going to be the smartest kid in class, but all you can do is work harder than everybody else. And I those words have never left my consciousness since then. And I think that's the way I live my life. That's the way I've worked. And whatever success I have is sort of rooted in that ethos that you don't have to be the smartest guy in the room, but just work a little bit harder than everybody else.
That sounds like your pops is right, because look at you go now, huh? You know, in terms of your personal heroes, who would have been, who are actually some of your personal heroes, and why do you hold them in such high regard?
You know, I'd say a couple of folks. You know, Dave Duffield, who founded PeopleSoft and founded Workday, has been I've been fortunate to have him as a mentor during my career. I learned an awful lot from him about customers, about teams, and things like that. So he's been a hero for me for a long time. You know, I have come, not that I never didn't, but I've come to admire Bill Gates more and more, particularly as his post-Microsoft life and the things that he's done and the work that he's done and the focus he's had on improving world health. And so I point to those two people as important heroes for me, people I've learned a lot from and continue to admire.
Fantastic. This is a question that it's an interesting question, but and it's a simplistic question, but do your family and friends understand what you do for a living?
Yes, I think so. My family in particular does. Particularly, and I'm fortunate to have I've only have one child, and she's a 17-year-old. I have a 17-year-old daughter who is, particularly in an era of Black Lives Matter and focus on inclusion and diversity, has really started to understand the importance of what we do in helping people get jobs. You know, the fact that people are using HireVue to improve the diversity of their organizations is, I think, meaningful to her as a young woman and thinking about the world today. We recently were announced that we were one of the top 30 companies in the U.S. for women to work for by an organization that tracks inclusion and diversity from a gender perspective. So that's been really meaningful to her as well. So that's you know, I feel like whatever we do from an organization perspective, I almost kind of got home and get judged by my daughter in terms of whether we're making the world a better place or not.
Yeah, I hear you on that in the accountability front, and that's been quite the joke on site about the real foreman is my wife in this project that we're undertaking domestically at the minute on our house. But I suppose as we wrap up here, Kevin, we always talk about the crack, C-R-A-I-C, which is an Irishism, if you like, for how we define ourselves in that, you know, we have the fun, the banter, the humour, but we get stuff done and we don't take ourselves too seriously, which for me is part of our kind of almost culture and leadership style. For you as the most senior of leaders in many organizations, I'm a big fan personally of Ken Blanchard as a leadership, you know, mantra. I've studied that, I've been trained in that, etc., and it works for me quite well. I've also studied servant leadership. I'm quite a big believer in that, is in that you are there to serve others. For you, if we're to ask one final wrap-up question, what does being a leader mean for you, and how do you permeate that throughout the organizations you're a part of?
I think the most important thing is just be human. You know, I have this role through luck and good fortune, not through any special God-given, you know, talent or experience. And part of my role is to help others. I have a different experience, different level of experience, but part of my role is to help others achieve their potential. And that is a responsibility that I really enjoy. You know, going back to the other component is that if you can't laugh at yourself, you shouldn't be doing this. You know, if you're going to be that serious about things, this isn't a great job for you to be in. So those are two things. I think one, making sure that you can demonstrate that you're human, that you know, you have the same challenges in your life. You have, you know, perhaps different challenges than others do, but at the end of the day, we're all human and we work as a team. We just have slightly different roles.
Yeah, indeed. I couldn't agree with that more. I think that's a great takeaway. And I think your humility is coming out to the fore there as well. And I think you certainly would have had good fortune, but I'm also a believer in fortune favors bear in mind. And, you know, you need to be ready to see an opportunity. And, you know, your training thus far to date brings you to that opportunity to recognize, to execute on it. Well, look, thank you very much for being a part of the show. We really appreciate it. Thank you for all your valuable insights. And we look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
Ross and John, thanks for including me. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Kevin.
You've been listening to the Global Tech Leaders Podcast, designed for both established and aspiring career-focused tech rock stars, as well as helping leadership figure out how to speak global in today's multicultural world. For further details, check out sf-talent.com.